So before we start this episode, I just wanted to let you know about the retreat I'm going to teach very shortly, well, in October, at Purple Valley Yoga in Goa, alongside my very special guest, Edwin Bryant. So it's a 2 weeks retreat. Both weeks, there'll be a Mysore class in the morning, every morning. And the first week, I'll be there teaching asana workshops in the afternoons. The second week, Edwin will take the reins for his knowledge and philosophy, including going through his well-known book on the Yoga Sutras in person. Further than that, Purple Valley Yoga Goa is generally great. A lovely shala, great food, wonderful staff, and set on a beautiful grounds with a pool. So I'm sure you're going to have a great time. See www.kionyoga for details, or go to yogagoa.com as well. I hope to see you there. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome today Stephanie Simon to Keen on Yoga, and her book is The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. Did I get that right, the title this time?
You got it right, yes.
Excellent, yes. Excellent. So thanks, Stephanie, for coming on. I've really enjoyed your book, and it's just a pleasure to actually speak to you in the flesh. Well, semi in the flesh.
Thank you. Yeah, it was very much a labor of love. So I enjoyed writing the book, and it's interesting to reflect on it now, too, because it came out some time ago and things have continued to evolve, certainly in the States and I imagine elsewhere. And, you know,
13 years, right?
It's 13 years, yes.
Right.
And so when you and I started chatting, one thing we sort of quickly recognized was that yoga is so kind of assimilated and just part of the atmosphere, part of many people's day-to-day lives. It's no longer almost worthy of note. Whereas even when I began, certainly when I began writing the book, and even when I concluded writing the book, it was still, there would still be developments that would kind of bubble up into collective consciousness that were controversial or interesting or weird. Whereas now we really take it for granted as part of certainly American culture. And so it's just interesting how it's, you know, there are no news articles anymore. It's just like, it's there, it's available, there are many types. Most adults that one comes across, certainly in the big cities of America, have tried it, whether or not they've actually enjoyed it or pursued it. So it's a really different moment here, which makes it interesting to sort of go back into the history, because I think we do forget how long it took to achieve this status as just another American pastime in this sort of almost boring way.
But you also mentioned in the book that it had those stages of evolution. I mean, especially around, when would you say that the asana starts to kick in? Around kind of 1920s, 30s with Theos Bernard?
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely evidence that even in the earlier, you know, even when Vivekananda was here, so in the late 19th century, that people were being taught asana. Like there was a
I thought he famously hated asana, didn't he?
He probably hated it, but other teachers who kind of came with him came, you know, because of the interest he started to generate, were definitely teaching asana. And there was, I remember, this New York Herald piece in 1898, and it had, the headline was something like, "The society ladies are doing this crazy thing called yoga." And it had illustrations of people doing the poses and talked about the poses. And it was quite scandalous at the time, partly because there was still so much racism too. So it was white ladies and Indian men that was problematic. But it was also just kind of, wasn't mean-spirited. It was a little bit lighthearted and just kind of titillating. And so the asanas were being taught really in the 19th century. Now they start to really become more available, you know, in the early 20th century. A character like Pierre Bernard, he's teaching the upper echelons, very wealthy people, and he's absolutely teaching hatha yoga. I mean, and a tantra, his kind of rendition of it. And then his nephew Theos kind of continues to bring that to America. And by the time you're in the 40s, you start to get people like Indra Devi, who has a more kind of a softer, more mass market appeal in the way she presents yoga. And partly it's where she is for some period of career. She's in Hollywood. So she starts to attract not just wealthy kind of society ladies, but movie stars, you know, and so she really is one of these forebears of what we experience as yoga today, which is it's for health, it's for healing, it's for, you know, healthy digestion, it's for toned limbs. And her book and record and teaching, you know, she kind of branded under this Forever Young, Forever Healthy, I believe is the title. Mm-hmm. And so she was really early in seeing that Americans were really open to yoga, the Hatha yoga, as long as you didn't go stray too deeply into the sort of spiritual, into the metaphysics and the what to Americans were more the stranger dimensions of the transformation in consciousness possible through yoga. You know, Indra Devi was not talking about raising your kundalini or opening your third eye, at least in her outward facing presentation. So you get this kind of steady progression, I think, in terms of making it accessible and making the asana practice accessible to Americans.
Well, the Vivekananda and the Indra Devi are probably public facing, kind of like going to the people, but I mean on their own terms, I mean, we know that Indra Devi was taught by Krishnamacharya and you know, had a kind of strong spiritual practice that she just chose not to share or divulge to the public.
Absolutely. They often had a kind of exoteric presentation that once you were even close to them, you know, I think Vivekananda in his speeches and, you know, he's at the World's Fair, that presentation was very agreeable and softened in some ways. Mm. Whereas, you know, he was absolutely, even though he famously did not want to teach the asana practice, he was definitely talking about moving the energy through the subtle body and using sexual energy for spiritual enlightenment in his teachings in small groups in New England. So it's not that he was completely taking all of the sort of controversial parts out of yoga. It's like the setting he was in. And yes, he did. He was concerned about teaching asana to Americans because he was concerned about, in some ways, what did come to pass, that it would be kind of broken off from the body of the teachings and taken for something else. And that also it was a little bit betray for Americans at the time.
I suppose it's easy to kind of blame the West for it, isn't it? But I mean, the movement of modernizing asana comes, well, we know with Krishnamacharya, who modernized it and used yoga as a therapy, right? And he was a classical Brahmin guy, like he, you know, so he did something really different. He also taught women, you know, obviously he had to be pressed, first of all, to teach Indra Devi. He wasn't planning on doing that, but some pressure was exerted upon him and he did. Well, she was kind of highly connected as well, wasn't she? But, you know, but you know, he also kind of mentions in, you know, books that about teaching women, and you know, and he allows foreigners to chant. In the end, he's kind of happy for them to chant, even if they don't know the exact meter, etc. And Vivekananda also kind of broke off and says, you know, doesn't he say something like, "I'm using my brain in service of my people," right? He comes over and he basically wants to generate money to bring back to India, right? So he has a humanistic concern and a background of more humanistic concerns than, say, maybe, you know, classical Vedanta would suggest towards life. That he's looking towards life now. He's looking towards yoga serving life rather than yoga serving, you know, spiritual oneness with God. Yes, or transcendence, exactly.
Yes. I mean, I think, I'm not sure that they saw a contradiction in those things, but yes. I mean, certainly in the presentation, but what you're pointing to is true, that, like, yoga became something that was easy to incorporate into being successful in this world. And I think in Vivekananda's case and Krishnamacharya's, there was a greater mission to their country and to the revival of yoga in India, or the revival is probably not quite the right word, but, you know, the sort of restoring its reputation. I haven't studied that deeply, but it certainly seems to have been a casualty of colonialism to some extent, and so their efforts really were a reclamation of their history and the history of the tradition. But certainly in the U.S., I think for Americans to feel that it was something they could participate in, they were, since they did not inherit a lot of the concepts of Hinduism, they had to kind of be sold on being helped now. So even someone like Yogananda in the 20s, he was extremely good at marketing yoga, like, help you be thinner, help you make money. Like, it was really like, this is not about departing from or transcending your current daily life or leaving your family and giving away your possessions and becoming some sort of, you know, wandering ascetic. It's like, yoga will help you now with the problems you have, whether that's your career, your marriage, your health. And that strain of marketing yoga as a almost a cure-all for worldly problems is very consistent through the history of yoga in America. And it's interesting how, and it was, so it's interesting to reflect on where yoga has landed, but that is absolutely right. And Vivekananda was keenly aware of this as well, although I think someone like Yogananda went even further in that direction. Who was in the who came here in the early 20s.
Yeah. I mean, paradoxically, though, there's still this kind of taint of exotification or kind of, you know, esotericism, you know, like in as much as Yogananda writes his book, which is, you know, I mean, it's kind of, the claims are spectacular, let's say, in the book, right? You don't think of the same guy placing ads, you know, in the papers and getting this whole organization around him before he travels to the next gig to make sure that people have, you know, bums are on seats, right? You don't, you know, so there is this kind of presentation, an outward-facing guru, which I think you point to in the book, is that, you know, when it comes to the US, just not so much in the UK, I think, but I think you say that the Swamis didn't came to the UK, but definitely it's a good, there's still this this taking on of the guru persona in the UK, I think, until fairly recently, right, that they're buying into the kind of magic of the guru, and yet on a very pragmatic schemata as well, as much as we mentioned in the talk we had before that Vivekananda says go into your own room and get the Upanishads out of yourself, or, you know, he's really giving the mantle to the individual to do what they want with it, which is a super new thing as well, because as we know, even in India today, like, you don't just just kind of like interpret the teachings how you fancy, right? Like, you know, like, you know, you read the commentaries, you know, you study and you learn to chant it. Like, it's not your opinion that matters, right?
Yes. I mean, I think that in terms of Yogananda and how esoteric that book came out 20 years or a little bit more after he arrived here. I believe it came out in 1946, but maybe even later. If I recall, I mean, certainly it wasn't, it maybe completed the manuscript then. So it was, so it was, I think around then that the book came out. It was not when he first came. And in some ways, I don't think he could have published it when he first came, because it was so out there. You know, what he recounts is like not, you know, beyond most Americans' comprehension. I think those stories of miracles might have been more familiar to Indians, you know, of like, just like, oh yeah, you know, I've heard that, this kind of a story before, maybe it's in a scripture, but it's not, there's not only one guy who can do that, which in, you know, Christianity is Jesus, right? like I think in Hinduism, there's just more possibility for that. So, but Yogananda, that book, you know, he really built his following here before that book came out. And I don't know that that book really was taken up as fervently until like the 60s, I think that book really saw a strong, you know, sales. I'm not recalling the data, but it felt like the book met its time quite a bit after he even passed away. I mean, there's always this kind of tension between, right, like yoga helping you in this life now, and this sort of longing for a mystical, magical experience that yoga somehow supports.
I think what you also point out too is that we assume that the trajectory is one way only, but when you look at, I mean, I wanted you to talk a little bit about I suggested were maybe the context of the modern roots of yoga, the transcendentalist movement in the US, you know, Emerson and Thoreau, and Thoreau says, you know, like, Sometimes I am a yogi, you know, when he's at Walden Pond, right? You know, but there's a very practical take at that point, though, when he's reading the Gita and he's writing these books and he's kind of going into town and he's having a little bit of wine or, you know, like it and he says, oh, I practice it a couple of weeks when, you know, sometimes when I can get the energy up, right?
Like,
It's a quite a kind of in the spirit of kind of the modern American and the kind of, you know, individuation and, you know, and self-autonomy. Yeah. I think it's grasping a different mantle than it later is when you, as you point out, in the 60s, when it all becomes rather mystical and about the guru. It kind of goes in a kind of circle in a way.
Yes. You know? Yeah, I think there's kind of sort of spirals. I think you're absolutely right. Mm. And there are these, you know, you could also think of it as kind of as dialectic. So I think the thing with Thoreau, I think you rightly point out, it's like his interpretation, it's kind of woven into his life. And he was never just in the cabin. He was always actually rather social. Like this notion that he was out in the cabin see anyone for months and months and months was always a bit of a myth or a mistake in a conception of what actually happened there. But there were actually no gurus here then. So like he had no choice but to make his own sense of those scriptures. And he didn't have the opportunity of sitting with Neem Karoli Baba, who never came here, but even a Muktananda, who came here in the early 70s, and have that experience of being around a different kind of energy where many, many students recounted this feeling of just being in his presence and maybe exchanging a couple words with Muktananda actually transformed their consciousness. Like that was just not available to Thoreau. So I think the depth of mysticism that was available to him or depth of connection was just somewhat limited by circumstance. But he certainly was interested in that dimension of it. He was not looking at yoga so he could be a better office worker or be calmer on his daily commute, you know. He was looking to plumb the secrets of the universe and of his, you know, consciousness as he understood it at the time, as were all the transcendentalists. And, you know, Emerson's transparent eyeball, I think of often when you look at like Advaita Vedanta and this sort of understanding of being pure awareness, this witnessing stance. So I do think the transcendentalists managed to experience these states of consciousness that yoga devs promise and offer when you practice either diligently or are with a guru, but they just had to kind of do it on their own. And then you see that kind of wheel turn towards a more practical application, but that doesn't really happen until we get kind of into the 20th century, early 20th century, and the Swamis, as we said, coming and having to find a way to convince Americans that this was something that could benefit them, even though it was heretical, being taught by men who looked very different than the people in power. And that's when I think you start to get the focus on the kind of practical integration, at least outwardly facing, to at least attract people to hear more. And so it goes on, and then those cycles go on from there.
I kind of feel like, having talked to you before and suggested that yoga was much more practically taken in the UK, I think the mystical thing crept in a lot earlier in the UK with the Theosophical Society, and Paul Brunton goes to India and he meets Ramana Maharishi and he writes The Secret, Secret Journey of India or something like that.
Well, you also had a different relation to India. I think it had, because of colonialism, I think India probably held or contained in the imagination already this exotic land, you know, where people were going there in real numbers and then coming back. Yeah. And there was probably more storytelling around the mysteries of India, where in America,
you just didn't have exposure to it. Not nearly as much.
Or only through the literature that was coming out of the UK. Right. So, and we were still building the country. I mean, we're still like, you know, pushing out the indigenous peoples and settling the West. So, so I think that puts a different spin on in our encounter with it.
So after the kind of Pierre Bernard and Theo Bernard and the omnipotent Om and this kind of thing that, you know, that kind of happens around the 40s, maybe into the 50s, does it? You wrote a excellent chapter in the book on the 60s and what happens to yoga in the 60s. Do you want to just unfold that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think, you know, so by the time you get to the 60s, I think what people don't realize is you already have two very strong strains of yoga, or presentations rather, of yoga. And one is this more practical presentation of Hatha yoga. And you have people like Richard Hittleman, kind of building on Indra Devi's legacy, and others who are like, the asanas are good for health, they're good for back pain. You know, you can come into a studio New York Grand Central Station in New York City and just, you know, do your class, and there's showers and saunas. And so that very kind of unassuming, almost bland presentation of yoga. And now, even though Richard Hittleman himself had a deep spiritual connection to yoga, he understood that if he was going to attract housewives and office workers, he was going to kind of play that mystical dimension down. At the same moment, you have, you know, certainly by the late 60s. And so, but even sort of starting in the mid 60s, the mystical strains start kind of returning. So, and there are a couple reasons for this. One is people start going to India. So the boomers are now coming of age. They're curious. Someone like Allen Ginsberg in 62, he goes to India. And there he's coming back recounting his experience. And he had a kind of ambivalent experience, but certainly was deeply moved by it. And the laws changed. By 1965, the laws changed, the immigration laws changed in the U.S., so it's now easier to come and stay if you are an Indian Swami or guru. And so, and then finally, and we'll go back to that in a second, there's a third dimension, which is people, the kind of preceding generation, so like of seekers, and this includes people like Aldous Huxley, who was living here, and someone like Alan Watts, also Brit, but living here. They have been kind of delving into Eastern religion, talking about it, often not just yoga, but, you know, Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, and you had the beat. So there was this kind of definite interest in the spiritual dimension or the spiritual possibilities of Eastern, a variety of Eastern traditions, including yoga. And then those guys start doing psychedelics. And they're like, aha, all those things that we've been reading about or kind of intimating, you do a, you know, a dose of mescaline or a dose of acid, like it cleanses the doors of perception. I have like, you know, it's like I experienced Satchitananda. Like I get it now. That's exactly what Huxley said in The Doors of Perception, which came out in the 50s. And he really saw this religious revolution brought about by psychedelics because he's like, oh, you've got God in a pill. It's right there. You don't have to do this long winding path. It's just right there. So you start to, you know, those, while it was early for the psychedelic revolution, those were strains that were starting to be present. And actually, acid becomes kind of relatively available in the early 60s in New York. It takes a little longer to hit the West Coast. So you start to have people experiencing these very different and altered states of consciousness that are extremely powerful. And so while the Beat Generation and those kind of the Huxleys and the Alan Watts and kind of their compatriots, they kind of studied Eastern mysticism and then did psychedelics, so they had that framework for it. By the kind of early mid-60s, it starts to reverse. And so you have kids that are doing psychedelics and having these very powerful transformative experiences. And then you start having the Swamis come. And so those things are kind of happening almost at the same time. And you also have figures like Leary and Ram Dass, who are, you know, psychonauts, who are really proselytizers for psychedelics, and using yoga imagery and text, and using Tibetan Buddhist imagery and text to kind of couch their psychedelic experiences. So these things are like kind of mixed up. But by the time the Swamis start coming in real numbers in the mid and later 60s, they really are starting to say, hey, look, guys, you can have those really powerful transformative experiences without the drugs. And you also, and just to go back to like the kind of avatars of this possibility, you had the Beatles doing this, like they kind of encapsulated that very experience, right? They were doing some acid, they were having these experiences, but George was really into TM, Transcendental Meditation, and, you know, studying with Maharishi Mahesh. And then
I don't think they could say it at the time, could they? I think there was maybe more honesty with the psychedelics in the US, but I think with the Beatles, they kind of couched it in kind of symbolic language, didn't they? They could never really say it in the mainstream, like, oh, we're taking drugs, you know, and you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, you know, isn't about, I don't know what they said it was about, something silly like getting on a bus or something and seeing a girl in the bus. I think it was something like silly like that.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
It was funny.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah.
They were circumspect about it, but they did have a similar trajectory of, like, you know, using psychedelics and then having an experience with meditation, particularly George, that led them to go to Rishikesh and study with Maharishi Mahesh, which is to say it began to be, like, reported on extensively, and celebrities were now getting involved with gurus. And so it now became much more of a possibility, both in the imagination of young Americans and in their reality, because the gurus started really arriving. And so that's this moment where it's very much about mysticism. It's very much about experiencing something that's very different from your daily life and life as laid out for you by post-war mores and norms. You're like, you know, you're going to go to college, get a job and be part of the, you know, corporate machinery.
And again, the spiral has come, you know, it's kind of come a full circle or a full spiral, as it were, because what you point out again is coming true now is that psychedelics are becoming popular, you know, very recently now, right? And you know, and then this is the hot topic now, whereas even a few years ago when we were talking of our starting yoga, and I know that Stephanie did Ashtanga as well for a while, and maybe still does, but we haven't talked about that. But, you know, it really wasn't the thing, you know, and maybe backpedal slightly and talk about how the kind of Western psychoanalysis took hold of yoga, because that was really the strain that kind of divides the two, right? Because when you talk about psychedelics, we're talking about God consciousness. But when we talk about kind of like Western psychology, it's something much more pragmatic, like integration of past experiences or resolution of traumas. And this is kind of going on in tandem with something else. And it kind of toggles between one and the other, doesn't it?
Yes. And so back to the 60s and then into the 70s, you know, you had this great interest in yoga and people going and living in ashrams and following gurus. Psychedelics kind of peaked in the late 60s and then they were outlawed. So to do psychedelics in the U.S. was to break, they became Schedule A, I believe, which is like, you're really breaking the law. This is not like a small problem. This is like a big deal. And so it was then they had to go underground. And so kind of at the same time, the gurus started, but as you kind of move into the 70s, the gurus start to lose their luster. And certainly by the late 70s, you have a lot of the surfacing of a lot of bad behavior by the gurus. So they really come off looking like these almost authoritarian abusers of power, and the sort of mystique of the gurus kind of, within a half decade, pretty much eviscerated by all of the bad news. Yeah. And almost every single one became the subject of allegations by more than one person, and then cover-ups within the organization. And so even if you can say that Muktananda did these amazing things and inspired so many people, it was hard to defend him at a certain point. And that was true of almost every single guru who came to the U.S., at the same time, I do think yoga was being incorporated and seen as something purely therapeutic, both on the physical side and in the psychological dimension. And so you see, for instance, the founding of Yoga Journal magazine in the 70s, and their presentation was this very worldly, therapeutic, both mentally and physically kind of yoga. And this sort of both the therapeutic version of yoga kind of won by the end of the 70s. And that the kind of dismissal or kind of the pushing away of the God consciousness, that it just became unfashionable to talk about yoga's path to see God. You know, Isherwood did a translation of the in the 40s of the Yoga Sutras, and it's like the title of the book is How to Know God. That book, like in the late 70s into the 80s, it's not that those books weren't available. It was just not how yoga was being talked about. You know, how people were really in general relating to it on a cultural level. Now, there are always individuals who are finding yoga and find this very mystical, spiritual version of yoga. But in terms of what the culture was able to metabolize and what was being, you know, the schools that were thriving, they were Hatha yoga schools inspired by Iyengar, which really denuded yoga of this sort of more overt religiosity and spirituality. And it was about the asana practice. You weren't chanting, you weren't even meditating so much. It was really that grounded. And then again, as people were talking about it, it was very much seen in psychological terms. It was not about transcending and having this such a different experience of subjectivity that you almost don't have the words for it. It was about, you know, being calm in the face of stress, about, you know, those sorts of things.
Well, so when people kind of think, well, now, oh, yoga is union. And if you were to question someone more, so what does this union mean? They would say, well, it's self-knowledge, isn't it? You know, it's self-knowledge. And it's like, well, that's such a common parlance. But actually, it wasn't really self-knowledge, was it? It was God knowledge. You know, yoga was there for the knowledge absolutely. Of God. It wasn't really there for the knowledge of self as an individual with a fragile ego that needed to be kind of integrated, right? So, I mean, I think... And that's such a, it's so close to one's nose that it's hard to see out of that now, where we feel like we're doing yoga for, you know, you ask anyone, these are being a better person, being, you know, like more centered, being, you know, like, you know, more awareness, being aware is the kind of, you know, the sine qua non now of, you know, what you need that for, I don't know, you know, if you're not looking for God, but apparently, you know, to be very aware of yourself.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think I kind of traced that transformation from when it was moving from God knowledge to sort of personal individual self-knowledge as the kind of going from a capital S self-knowledge, which was how many Indian, you know, promulgators of yoga translated God knowledge itself. But the self was the transcendental self. And goes to a little s, right? A not capitalized self-knowledge. And that happens like in the late 70s in the US. And that is what kind of where we kind of landed and what became the yoga that has been more fully assimilated here, which is, again, not to say you cannot find other versions and go to the more complete understanding of yoga with specific teachers, but when you're going to take a yoga class in the US at this point, it is all about that small S, not about the big S, more often than not. And, you know, we had to go through another turn of the wheel. And this time it was less about the remystification of yoga, and it was more about presenting it as a more demanding, like we were still wanting something from the practice that the fully softened version of Hatha yoga taught in the 70s at the Y, or the even the early 80s at the Y in the US, didn't satisfy. Which is to say, when you had Pattabhi Joyce and Bikram present their versions of yoga, Ashtanga and Bikram yoga, I think Americans kind of welcomed those practices and those teachings because they were more demanding. And even if they weren't demanding in terms of I'm on a spiritual path and I'm going to meditate at 4 in the morning and I'm going to chant for 2 hours a day and then maybe I'll do a little asana and then I'll read scripture, there was still something quite demanding about the physical practice that felt somewhat salvific and a little bit more both consonant with fitness culture at the time, but also I think it did feel like maybe an alternative path to just going down
the wheel.
So
just doing a little bit of yoga, as you say,
there's something about how you commit to it that I think was part of the appeal.
I think it's like, it's another turn of that wheel, isn't it? Because you don't have to any longer go. I mean, you document in a, you know, great, I can't remember that which chapter it is, but they're going to do the psychedelics and they live in an ashram together, and then half of the gang like split off to a different kind of ashram where they're not doing the psychedelics. And it's, you kind of get this feeling that and also your Theos Bernardi kind of has a commune around him, and I think, you know, you've mentioned a number of times in the book that it has to be this all-encompassing kind of life. Style where you're in it or you're not, you know. And then, you know, the 80s come and it's like, well, you know, that all didn't work, you know, and everyone just kind of packs up the bag, and Iyengar's still teaching, obviously, and, you know, he's teaching under the auspices of physical education, and these postures do this for the health, you know. And it's, you know, and then it comes, the 90s come, and it's almost like that gets, you know, one gets cynical about that, right? And want a bit more again, but they want a bit more in a way that they're not going to go to an ashram anymore, but they're going to kind of take it in the everyday life, you know, kind of incorporate it in a kind of, in a different manner again.
So absolutely. And the house was Millbrook, and that was in upstate New York. Peggy Hitchcock was this wealthy woman who hosted basically Timothy Leary and his minions, and Ram Dass was there for a while, and Metzger there, the third of the trio, and they were blending, but it was really Leary show, and they were blending psychedelics and Eastern mysticism and a lot of yoga. And then it's true, there were some refugees from Ananda Ashram that came and lived there. But the point you're making, which is absolutely true, and did not just hold with Millbrook, but with ashrams around the country, was you were dedicating your entire life. You were shedding all outward appearances of being an ordinary American, to the point where parents got really worried and would go kidnap their kids and deprogram them because they were involved in these horrible yoga cults. And so, you know, I think in many cases, the kids really felt harmed by the kidnapping because they had chosen this very complete and very different lifestyle. They had chosen happily to live in at a place where you woke up at 4 and chanted and lived communally. But because of those allegations and because of the kind of the dark clouds that came around so many of the gurus, we really rejected that wholesale. And then we're not satisfied with the very kind of softened version, what's called marshmallow yoga, and you hear people referring to it that way. Like, it's just, there's not much to it. But we didn't want to go all the way back to that. You have to let go of everything, and all, you know, you really leave your job. We wanted some way of experiencing a deeper commitment, but not as to the levels of the 60s and early 70s. And so I do Ashtanga and Bikram. Really, you couldn't just show up once a week. You couldn't just show up even maybe twice a week and you really had to commit to doing that practice. To survive it.
And the early morning, the early morning nature. The heat, the early morning, the striving. The ritual around the repetition.
I think the ritual was, and the consistency of the container in both cases, right? So you could go anywhere in the country to an Ashtanga studio or to the studio, and you got exactly the same thing, and you knew exactly what you were getting. Yes, teachers, they may have slight differences in presentation, but they were very minor. And I do think that the communities that arose around these types of yoga were very strong, which we were also craving. But again, it wasn't like having to pack up and move to upstate New York. It was, you were able to have a job. I'm not so sure you were able to have kids and a job, but you could have kids or a job. You could probably have one or the other and still participate in a very consistent way with this type of yoga.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you drew attention to in the book also was that kind of fallow period in the 80s. And I hesitate to find anyone who pops up in my mind apart from BKS Iyengar, who kind of bridges that gap you know, or in a consistent way through the 70s to the 80s. Can you think of any other figures that were around in the 80s? Because there was a lull. I mean, we talked before we started this interview about how we when we got into it, it was still fairly unknown. And I would talk, and I'm sure many people that are listening, if they'd started in the 90s, they would say they were doing yoga. And someone, as I mentioned, they would do the Padmasana position and say Om and put their hands in yoga mudra, you know. And you'd say, no, like I'm doing something a bit more dynamic, like it's moving, you know, like, you know, it's like kind of gymnastic here, you know, talking about Ashtanga, you know. And there was still that idea of it back at that time. So it's kind of fallen down or changed. Because when you talk about Theos Bernard, for example, I didn't realize, you know, he also has that girlfriend or that, you know, they're kind of the outward facing presentation of his yoga system, right? And I can't remember her name. I mean, very dynamic systems of gymnastics, right?
Theos was, I mean, Pierre Bernard had Blanche DeVries. So Pierre.
Blanche DeVries. Sorry. I think.
That was Pierre Bernard.
That's who I'm thinking of.
And she ended up teaching Christopher Isherwood out in Hollywood. So, and she was very, she was a dancer by training. So she brought all of that kind of athleticism and grace and agility to it. But I think what you're pointing to is that, you know, that on the one hand, yoga was still present here, but it was really not part of the cultural conversation. And it was present in the form of Iyengar, mostly, which you mentioned before. Bikram was definitely building, but again, he wasn't quite, he was starting to get some attention. It kind of went up and down a bit. And Madhavi Joy started making trips to the U.S. too and starting to slowly build a following. But the kind of real energy around yoga, it took till the 90s to really gather enough kind of heat and light, and the celebrities that were practicing either Bikram or Ashtanga to really bring it back to the fore, and for I think Gen X in the US to kind of reclaim it. And the way we reclaimed it really did have to do initially with, oh yeah, yoga can whip my ass as much as aerobics or running, or, you know, like you were saying, like it is now equally physically demanding as these other types of movement and exercise. So it was not saying, oh, this is a path to know God. It was more like, it's okay. I mean, you think about culturally what's going on in the US, we had just come out of Reagan years, AIDS crisis. So we were not a hopeful or an idealistic country. We were a kind of like somewhat potentially cynical and pessimistic country in the rise of the Christian right. You know, so yoga was not our kind of spiritual salvation at first. I think many people began yoga because they kind of got curious and because it's like, oh, maybe there is a way of practicing yoga that feels satisfying physically. Now, I do think many, many people may have started with this curiosity in the physical practice and then understood and began to become more invested in yoga as a spiritual technology. And it's kind of almost like a Trojan horse, right? And I think that was always true, that the asana practice was put forward and some number of people start to go down the rabbit hole and land right where one would hope, right? Seeing and understanding the completeness of yoga and all its possibilities. But I think the resurgence really in the 90s in the US came about because you had these very demanding practices had this very ritualistic quality that could shed some of that ladies, you know, middle-aged ladies at the Y baggage, cultural baggage. Now you see yoga at the Y. And I'm a middle-aged lady. And it's, you know, it's at the Y, it's at Xmonox, but it's also at, you know, Eddie's Broom Street Yoga Temple and Ganesha Temple and, you know, many other such places.
Yeah, I think it's called Broom Street again. It has had different incarnations, hasn't it? Was it called Ganesha and now it's Broom Street? But I think Eddie is a good case, a point, example, really, in doing a number of things, right? Like in a demanding practice and bringing the kind of, you know, the religious aspect to it. And now we talked a little bit before how Eddie's now doing the therapeutics. He's putting it to modern science. And, you know, and we see that, you know, from Kavalyananda, this wish to ally yoga to modern scientific understanding. Yeah. But on the other hand, there's also this kind of crazy yoga for good booty, and, you know, like, and more and more, like, you know, it's kind of like vinyasa XYZ, or, you know, like yoga box I've seen, you know, like, you know, anything.
Yeah.
The yoga chocolate in the beer is even more crazy than yoga goat, I think, you know.
Yoga and cannabis.
It's crazy, isn't it? I don't know. It's an open-ended question, really. Where do you think we're going now with it? Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that we no longer have nearly as much pressure to convince people that yoga is something that you benefit from. And which is to say, I think most Americans, if asked, they'd either have like whatever yoga, like they'd either have no strong opinion or they'd be like, yeah, yoga is probably good for me. I don't do it. And then of course you have those who are practice consistently. You know, look, anything that becomes really popular, you're going to get all sorts of kooky permutations, you know, like God bless the people who do yoga and wine. I'm not much interest myself, but I think it's kind of silly, but, you know, someone might do that. And with all of these things, it may be the way they do encounter yoga, and they do start to get curious and begin to understand its possibilities. I do think, as you mentioned, this wish to explain yoga in scientific terms has been with us even since the early 20th century. When it became clear that, like, Americans really, that language was very convincing to Americans. And really, since the early 20th century, the technology to be able to understand the impact of yoga has evolved so dramatically. So whereas people would sort of make these claims about yoga's effects, we now actually have a scientific vocabulary and the actual technology to back up those claims. I find it personally less appealing. Like, I think it's interesting that we feel such a strong need to kind of justify yoga in scientific terms. However, it's kind of interesting to note that our instruments can now measure the impact of pranayama on the vagus nerve. And so for some people, I think they really need to feel like the assurance of this is clinically working versus their subjective experience of like, I feel a lot better after yoga class. And I can subjectively experience the power. So I do think, you know, to your point, Eddie's really explored all dimensions, and I think he's been very dedicated to helping people understand the depth of yoga. And science is one way of making it comprehensible and legible to Americans. That's been very powerful for the last, and as you said, 100 years.
I mean, not only Kavalyananda in Kavalidam, but also, I mean, Vivekananda comes over and starts talking about Brahman in terms of ether, doesn't he? I forgot that, you know, he really tries to kind of put a kind of a scientific spin on it. You know, so that's, you know, it's from the get-go, really, that, you know.
Before the 20th century,
Do you think that somehow, due to the kind of wish to... I don't know how to say it, so objectifies one's experience, the kind of subjective pioneering now being so much lesser... something is perhaps shifted or for the worse in terms of one's own trajectory with yoga, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to stick your head above the parapet anymore, you know?
So that's an interesting point, because I think that right now, certainly in the US, a lot of the energy around exploring these states of consciousness, the God consciousness, are kind of located in psychedelics, and yoga is kind of more assimilated and more for like functioning well. Again, I don't think that's for everyone, but I do think in terms of from the cultural perspective, the conversation around psychedelics is like, it's very much like, on one hand, they enable these mystical experiences. On the other hand, let's get legalization. And the path to legalization is to prove scientifically the therapeutic value of psychedelics. So you actually see the same dynamic of like, is it for God consciousness or is it for healing depression? And that the path to mass acceptance is to insist upon the therapeutic value. Now, what's interesting about psychedelics, though, is there are now even studies that show it is the very mystical experience that delivers the therapeutic value. And
yeah. And why is it the polarity that has to...
I'm not an expert, but...
It's true that you've got the polarity that's always been there. And it's like, well, Jung, I mean, I was reading Jung today, and he has the... Did you hear the Oxford group? He had a group at a certain point that was for... It was like kind of like a forerunner of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was basically based on having a religious experience.
Uh-huh.
That if you didn't, you know, that they would cure... alcoholism for many people. They had to have a religious experience, otherwise they would never be cured. And that's Jung saying that, you know. So that's the two things going together, isn't it? Like modern, you know, like life and living an okay life and not being alcoholic, and also living up here, you know. But there seems to be this kind of binary kind of schism, which is still equating now, as you mentioned today.
Yes, and I think it's partly because, well, in the US, we have the separation of church and state. And there are laws governing psychedelics. And so it starts to get very weird if you're saying, this is a path to God, make it legal. It then becomes part of the protection of freedom of religion versus our kind of capitalistic society that wants to cash in on these powerful substances that do have very positive effects for people kind of in this worldly way. I think in general, Americans are uncomfortable one, I think it's human to create dualities. Two, I think Americans in particular are still uncomfortable with mystical states in the sense of like being something that is available, this that may be desirable, that there are many paths to those states, but you can have them now. Versus, you know, we're still a Christian country. God is someone you experience after death. So I think there are all these forces at play that make it still a little bit uncomfortable to talk about how to know God in a way that's here and now, that you can have that. And I think with yoga, I think because it's so familiar, it's almost like it's so ordinary now. How could that get me to this, you know, Satchitananda? How could I experience a bliss state? Wait, I just go to the Y and I do yoga. So I think it almost has a different burden now to convince people that it can be extraordinary versus psychedelics, which are still not legal in most places. And
maybe that's part of it, isn't it? You know,
I mean, we talked before. Storytelling around them.
Yeah. We talked before, like we started about the yoga mom, and that's, I think, a specific term in the US, but I'm sure it's come over to Britain as well. Everyone knows what it is anyway. And it's the most kind of socially conformative, kind of conventional, really, right? Like a yoga, you know, I guess it's a pejorative term in some respects, but you know, it's a term of a conformism,
cliche,
really.
Yeah.
It's a cliche, it's a conformist, it's someone who's a regular society person, right? Like who fits into the boxes and, you know, is acting accordingly to what's, you know, expected upon them, you know, and I think maybe that's, I mean, would you think, and if we're just kind of trying to kind of think of a way to wrap up and conclude our chat, you know, do you think the next turn of the wheel is for yoga to shed that again and become something radical? Because, I mean, just thinking in a very most practical terms about the whole yoga Ashtanga going to Mysore thing, right? And now it's so easy to go to Mysore, right? And everyone's going and get the, you know, and it's not mystical anymore. So there's no kind of effort, right? And so in some respects, that whole kind of, that kind of spiritual journey of doing something which is kind of uncertain, hard, which does demand you to be different and to you know, put your hand up and say, well, I'm, you know, like I'm doing something rather different here that my parents might not approve of and society might think well of. Do you think, you know, that needs to happen to yoga again? Or do you think that will happen to yoga again?
So it's interesting. It's a good question. Like, you're right. We're kind of set for another turn of the wheel. And if psychedelics become legal more widely, you could imagine another version of the kind of late 60s, early 70s, where people have this experience of God consciousness, but they really want to find a different way of of activating that. They don't want to drop acid all the time. So you could imagine it being the kind of a kind of ancillary to the kind of repopularization of psychedelics. But the world feels so flat right now that it doesn't feel like, and this is because of the internet and the accessibility of everything everywhere all the time. It's hard to imagine it having the charge of like, I'm doing something really different, except in some place in the US, books are banned. Many books are banned about many things that seemed completely uncontroversial even 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I can imagine in pockets of the US, that kind of regaining some of the like revolutionary charge, where it's hard to get certain information or harder to get certain information, and where a version of life is being kind of in a very authoritarian way being presented. We'll see. I mean, I also think what we're facing is a huge amount of uncertainty coming up with climate catastrophe and you know, what my kids are going to experience, and how do these traditions speak to them or not when they're, you know, they may speak very strongly to them because there's a quality of inner peace amidst whatever is happening, or they may find them insufficient as they are trying to address all sorts of really practical, like, where do you live that's safe? You know, are we dealing with a real, actual, you know, it's no longer resisting consumerism, right? It's like surviving on the apocalypse. So that's a dramatic ending, but it's hard to know. It'll be, I think we'll have our answer in about 10 years, Adam. I think we'll, I think we will.
Whenever it's moved to places that can't be flooded or burnt or, Yeah, I don't know. I think I kind of feel like yoga has to separate itself for now from the physical gymnastics aspects again to reclaim some kind of sense of integrity or you know, a kind of validity in people's eyes, right? I think it's been too, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think it's been too mixed in with selling people, you know, cosmetically now, that to regain, you know, some kind of credence to those people that are really looking. It probably, you know, and all the stuff with yoga injuries now, like, you know, yoga is, you know, there's, you know, since I think, I can't remember the famous article in the New York Times. I can't remember the guy who wrote that article.
Yeah. I remember that one. Yeah.
Since that point, there's this whole yoga injures you. And now there's this whole hypermobility thing, like, yoga, you know, you don't want to stretch. Stretching's dangerous, you know? So
yeah,
I kind of feel like its future lies within how it's defined in a physical sense, perhaps, you know, in terms of moving forward to the next turn of the wheel. I mean, also with the psychedelics thing, I would just kind of say that, remember in your book, you say that Leary, actually, I didn't realize this, you know, he kind of splits, he kind of has this psychedelic thing, and then he kind of realizes he can't, you know, pop acid every day, that he has to, yeah, you know, it's to do something to kind of have that on an experience without drugs, right? So
yeah. Oh, that was Ram Dass. Leary went to the grave on acid.
Did he?
Yeah. but Ram Dass did, and so yes, I can see. I think you're right. I think it has to, you know, for to regain the possibility of yoga as a path to God consciousness or divine or transcendence. It will have to somehow relate differently to this very this notion of yoga as exercise, and that, you know, which is the common notion, and psychedelics may or may not be part of how that happens. It's going to be interesting, and it may be that it's even referred to something as something like yoga might not even be in the branding, right? Even though you and I would know, oh, that's yoga. Like, it may be a teacher comes along who calls their movement something else, in the way that someone like Yogi Bhajan called his movement the healthy, happy, holy, the 3-3-HO, whatever. So we shall see. It'll be interesting, though. There is room for it. There is room for another turn.
Well, I think whether we like it or not, it will turn again. And hopefully we'll be meeting up in a number of years to discuss the next phase. Yes. Do you plan on writing any more? Would you write another chapter or write another book? What are you working on these days?
So I have a feeling I'll write another book. It'll be probably quite different. I don't know that it'll, I mean, that book required so much research. I was in archives and libraries, and I don't know that I'll do that kind of book again, but I do think I'll write at least another book, maybe more than another book. And I think the themes that yoga addresses and that I was addressing through other people and through the history of yoga are still very near and dear to my heart, like how to live, how to experience the divine in this life. I still find those really interesting questions to ask and try to answer. And then in the other part of my life, I work with startups as an advisor. So I've been in the business of helping normalize new technology, whether those are spiritual technologies or actual digital technologies.
I was going to ask you what, you know, just to bring it down to a practical level, what you're doing now, because I know you're not in academia, are you? And you've got two children, you said.
I have two teenagers. Yes.
Yeah. Do you practice yoga?
A little bit, you know, my 16-year-old will do some sun salutations. You know, I bet when they're a little older, they will. And I feel like, you know, I still practice a little. It's, you know, it's challenging right now, given everything going on. But I can see a day where that's reintegrated a little bit more even than now.
In your life.
In my life, and maybe theirs too, you know, right, because those movements, I mean, I will leave them to their own spiritual paths and journeys, but I do think, you know, they certainly, my 16-year-old understands how those movements really help him. And he's an athlete, he's a soccer player, so, or a football player, you would say. And so could use some of that different kind.
Football's
of
becoming popular, is it there? Soccer?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Funny. Americans figured it out.
Right. At last, you don't have to dress up in massive pads and jump at each other anymore. So, what does he, just to finish off, what does he take it? You know, what does he think of you? He's not looking for God, so he's just literally looking at it in a physical perspective, is he? And what's Generation Z or whatever they call it? How are they looking at it?
So the thing about Phoenix, who's my 16-year-old, so his dad is studying Tibetan Buddhism and is like a hardcore Buddhist, and sort of also kind of the integration of psychedelics and Buddhism. So he has a lot of baggage around this stuff, for good or bad. Like, but he hasn't rebelled. So he will read Watts and loves Alan Watts. You know, he hasn't read Autobiography of a Yogi yet, but he may. So for him. However, he's not deeply engaged in that. I mean, he's figuring out where he wants to go to college. So, but he understands yoga is part of this bigger complex of ideas, and it is a spiritual technology, even though he might only do sun salutations to stretch his calves. So, but he understands that there is this huge universe that he could tap into were he interested. And I think he'll end up, you know, spending some time in India. You know, he's a very adventuresome kid, so I do think he has that in him.
I guess he's not like the kind of benchmark of a regular child. And if you've got a father, we can't take him as a general example.
No, but
nevertheless, you know, it does raise a point that, you know, obviously everything is out there now for everyone, and you know, you don't have to search very far to find Alan Watts. I mean, you know, like you could find him just like scrolling through YouTube. You know, you could find one of his little recorded talks. So the technology is endemic, and the messages as well. It's just how to make it esoteric again, you know, like how to make it special and how to make it like secret again, you know, because it is so like we spent ages before starting this podcast, well, little time anyway, me and Stephanie, trying to figure out a way in here to what we're going to talk about, because it's too close. I mean, it's like closer than your nose. You can't even see yoga anymore. It's just become so ingrained in the matrix.
And it's interesting too, whether it needs that. I mean, we feel like part of the joy of yoga was to the feeling of discovery. Now, it may still, it's interesting, it may still have that, retain more of that than we think, because you can get kind of the superficial hit, but you still have to invest into really, really unlock the practice and understand it. It still requires effort or attention and looking. So in a way, there's so much information about everything available all the time. It's, you know, there's still the discovery, because even though it's all available, there's so much of it. right? So that might be where someone like Phoenix, it's superficially available, but it still requires that effort to really understand it deeply. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. I think some people will come to it in a profound way. I think that's always going to be the case. And I think they still will feel like it's a discovery because they haven't internalized this information. We have, but they haven't.
And also, I suppose, how it's held with or without in terms of against society, isn't it? Because when I started it, it was still something which was somewhat niche, somewhat kind of rebellious even to do, you know, to pursue something in terms of an everyday practice, certainly was somewhat weird to people, right? You do this every day, they would always say, right? Every day, like, you know. So it was, I don't think I would have gotten into it now, let's say. You know, but it was something which it's a statement, you know, I'm going to do this thing every day. And, you know, it was very much against modern capitalism and against the kind of status quo, right? And so it was a definition that I think I took upon myself, you know, more than the kind of technology of self-enlightenment or whatever we want to, you know, we've been talking about a little bit, more of a kind of social statement, which it'd be interesting to see how that bears out in the future, right?
Currently,
doing yoga is a social statement of conformism. It's quite the opposite.
Yes. I think that is true, but I think anything that requires true dedication and that has that quality of ritual and that might complicate a routine that is more normal, I think still could retain some of that. We're kind of a little bit outside the norm, but it's, you know, they're not even going into work anymore in the US. Like, people are still working remotely. So even understanding something as a ritual that you have to build your life around, rather than that something that might even make certain jobs hard. Like, I couldn't have been an investment banker practicing almost every morning. And there were a few, but, you know, even that's different. So it's hard to understand how, if people will see it as an antidote to modern post-industrial capitalism or not. But I even think that's so hard to predict how that's going to shift in our coming world. You know, there's a lot, the straight line version of what we're living now is, I don't think, exists anymore.
All right. Well, let's see where we end up in a few years, everyone. And just remains to say thank you very much, Stephanie. I mean, we could carry on. I'm going to have more and more questions coming now. But anyways, we'll leave it there. And thanks, Stephanie, very much. And read the book. It's a great book, Subtle Body, Origins of Yoga in America. Excellent book. And also really interesting to compare Stephanie, say, to another guest, Suzanne Newcombe, who talks about yoga in the UK and how it had a slightly different trajectory in the UK. So read both books. Suzanne's written an excellent book as well. Anyway, Stephanie, thank you very much for coming. It's been really such a nice chat today I've had. So thanks again.
Thank you so much.